Capital Peace for the opportunity given to us to speak before this audience. I have been made to understand that I'm speaking to a very knowledgeable group, people who know just about everything that needs to be known about South Africa and Southern Africa, and therefore I needn't bore you with a lot of historical detail and statistics and so on, but just to be on the topic. I'm going to try and do that as much as I can. I have been asked to speak about current ANC strategies, especially in the light of the developments in Southwest Africa. Because the developments in Southwestern Africa have not unfolded to the full, it is a bit difficult to talk in terms of strategies afterwards, because I think a great deal of what will happen afterwards will, to a very large extent, depend on the outcome of the talks themselves, the outcome of the process in Namibia and in Angola. And also given the fact that at the beginning of the Namibia process, there have been some difficulties experienced, difficulties which have threatened the entire peace process itself, it is very difficult to talk in terms of ANC strategies afterwards. I think it's only fair to assume that we are talking on the basis of an unfolding process which leads eventually to peace in Namibia, peace in Angola, and independence of Namibia. But however, we shall not exclude the possibilities of some kind of breakdown in the peace process in Southwest Africa. And this, to a large extent, will affect ANC's position on a whole host of things. There are a number of points that need to be made here in relation to the Southwest Africa Agreement, and in particular, the position of the ANC. Now, the ANC has taken the position that it actually welcomes the entire process. The ANC has gone on record as saying that the Namibia peace process, the independence of Namibia, and all the agreements that have been signed leading to peace in Angola and independence of Namibia are highly welcome. We think they are welcome because we think the people of Angola deserve to have peace after 500 years of colonialism and a number of years of struggle. We think it is only fair for the people of Namibia to be given the opportunity to address their own problem, developmental problems. The second thing is we think that it is important for the people of Namibia, they also deserve to be independent after so many years of struggle, after so many years of colonialism, and that therefore any process that brings about an end to the conflict in the region is highly welcome. So that therefore we welcome the process not so much because of what it will do or what impact it will have on South Africa, but in itself. But it is also true to say that we think that the peace process in Southwest Africa is to a very large extent going to have a very serious impact on our situation in South Africa. And that therefore, to that extent, we think that the influence that it might have can only be a very positive one. It is therefore for this reason that we highly welcome the developments in the region. But having said that, we would like also to underline here the point that has been underlined repeatedly in ANC statements, that one, we approach the whole question of South Africa's sincerity in the entire process in a very skeptical way, and we cannot be blamed for this. In other words, having welcomed the process, we therefore hasten to caution maximum vigilance on the part of all those that have dealings with South Africa on this question. We think that South Africa's track record is nothing to be very jovial about when you consider the kinds of international commitments that South Africa has made before and the commitments that South Africa has violated. History abounds with examples. We need not go into this. The Nkomati Accord and all sorts of accords and agreements that have been entered into by South Africa. So we have no faith in the ability of the apartheid regime to carry through, which is not saying that the apartheid regime is not going to be forced to carry through its own apart. But what it actually means is that the apartheid regime may be forced to in fact honor its agreements. Let's examine one little aspect. South Africa, according to the agreements in Namibia, or on Namibia, South Africa is expected to supervise a free and fair election in Namibia. Now, coming from a country where a free and fair election is an unknown quantity, it's very difficult for us to visualize how the South Africans can actually be very genuine in carrying through with this. They are supposed to ensure that Namibia becomes a non-racial country, a country where there's freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom of speech and everything. And it is precisely those elements that are missing in South Africa. No non-racial democracy, no freedom of speech, no freedom of expression, and everything else. So under the circumstances, one finds it very difficult to visualize South Africa in the role of a regime which can help to facilitate a process which it so violently opposes in its own area, in its own country. We find this very difficult. But of course, one wants to emphasize here again that this is not saying that the South Africans are not going to deliver, because here what will determine the outcome in the final analysis will also be the extent to which the international community brings pressure to bear on South Africa to deliver. So it is, in fact, something that is worth considering, and something that persuades us into not just throwing the whole agreement out of the window. We think that the agreement can work, provided the regime exercises maximum, or the international community exercises maximum pressure. We are persuaded to take this position because we all are aware, I think, all of us who have been following the developments in Southern Africa, are aware that the South Africans did not enter the negotiations willingly. As a matter of fact, they were brought kicking and yelling to the negotiating table. And there are a number of factors which have, in our view, led to the South Africans getting involved in the agreements. One, the internal situation itself in South Africa. The state of emergency has been in operation for quite some time now. But in fact, the continued existence of the state of emergency, much more than proving that the regime is having the situation under control, only goes on to testify that in fact the regime is unable to control the situation in normal ways, and therefore has got to arrogate to itself these kinds of powers that require it to apply martial law in order to keep the lead on the development. So we're therefore saying that the continued state of emergency in South Africa underlines the extent to which the democratic forces are perceived by the South African regime as posing a very serious threat. So the internal situation has had, the political situation has had a tremendous effect in South Africa's decision to participate in the negotiations. Second, the economy of South Africa over the years has been unable to sustain, to withstand the pressures on it brought about by its continued involvement in Angola, and to maintain 100,000 strong force in Namibia at the conservative estimate of something like $1 million a day. And we know that this is in fact a very conservative estimate. So that we are saying, therefore, the combination of this expenditure plus the pressures that have been applied on South Africa through sanctions, which incidentally a lot of people seem to suggest that are not working, but the South Africans themselves have admitted that they are working. That's why they are so serious and so severe on people that advocate in South Africa for sanctions to be imposed against the regime. So combination of sanctions which are working, the expenses incurred or expenditure incurred in keeping South African forces in Angola and in Namibia, the turbulence, political turbulence within South Africa, all of these have in fact tended to have a very serious impact on South Africa, and therefore pushing the South Africans in the direction of negotiations. There are other factors, of course, that come into the picture here, some of which are the relaxations of tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union. I think it is a very important factor because for quite some time there was a tendency, particularly in Western countries, to, and especially during the Reagan administration, to want to perceive the South African question within the or through the prism of East-West tensions and East-West rivalries. And when once this rapprochement seems to be taking place between the Soviet Union and the United States, this has tended to remove this element out of the South African conflict and indeed other conflicts in the world, which has enabled certainly the international community to perceive the South African question for what it really is and to address the real problems that are there rather than problems getting obscured by other considerations. So I am therefore saying that there have been a number of pressures, a number of factors that have led to the South African regime getting to the negotiating table. The one important element that one should not forget is also the situation, military situation on the ground. We have been talking so much about Guido Carnaval and its implications on the South African Defense Force. The fact that 1,000-strong South African troops were surrounded at Guido Carnaval, and it was going to be very difficult for the regime to extricate itself, particularly because it had lost the superiority in the air, a thing which had, in fact, decided the battles in Angola that had been raging throughout. Now that the Soviet-Cuban and Angolan combination had, in fact, eliminated South Africa's superiority, it became therefore possible to have a situation where South African forces could be constrained in Angola. So it was in fact a way of helping to extricate the South African forces out of that whole mess. All this points in one direction. The point I'm trying to make here is that if it is agreed that South Africa went to the negotiating table because of all these pressures, we do not think that it is illogical to assume that when once these pressures are removed, then we are likely to get a South African regime which has no qualms about taking the entire agreement and throwing it out of the window. So that therefore, instead of arguing for the lessening of pressures on the regime, I think we really ought to be talking in terms of additional pressure on the regime so that we make sure that the regime follows through. A number of people, a number of circles, particularly in the United States, especially in Washington, have come up with a thesis that at this point in time, what is needed in Southern Africa is an opportunity to be given to the regime to enable it to follow through, enable it to carry on. It's part of the bargain by not insisting on, you know, sanctions, for one thing, by not talking in terms of pressurizing the regime. The a number of Western countries have been sending out feelers, for instance, to the ANC to say, well, perhaps your own contribution to the Namibia peace process would be by lessening rather than intensifying your own struggle. That way you are allowing of a situation where the regime, which has to act all the time looking over its shoulder at the far-right elements, the far-right-wing elements within the South African body politic, who are very skeptical about the role that the regime has played in pulling out of Namibia and also allowing for a situation where you know, they are no longer perceived to be present in Angola, that it would be a great disservice to those elements and those forces within the South African government to want to intensify your struggle and therefore tying the hands of those who are trying to bring about change. that perhaps our contribution would be to decelerate rather than accelerate the struggle. Unfortunately, we do not see that way. We think that it is, in fact, a wrong approach, a wrong strategy, to want to say that at this point, let us talk more in terms of accommodating the regime. We are also very skeptical of such views because we feel that there are certain people who are too prone to want to embrace the apartheid regime. Over the years, the regime has been coming up with what it calls reforms, which were really non-fundamental. I mean, they did not touch the essence of apartheid. But, you know, no sooner would the regime announce these measures than we'd be having, you know, international acclaim, everybody coming, praising the regime for, you know, a step in the right direction, common sense prevailing, this kind of attitude. When, in fact, there's absolutely no forward movement in terms of resolving the South African question. And so the tendency has been to accommodate the Pretoria regime instead of encouraging the regime to move in positive directions. This is our situation, our perception of Namibian and Angolan settlement. But how does it affect the ANC and how does it affect our own struggle? Some people are saying because the ANC has been forced to withdraw its military personnel from Angola, this is in fact a plus for the regime, and it has created some problems for the ANC. Perhaps the point that one needs to make here is that the decision was taken by the ANC to withdraw its military personnel from Angola in consultation with the frontline states. The major reason for this was that it was felt that precisely because the Pretoria regime would be looking for all kinds of excuses in not coming about with, you know, meeting its own part of the bargain. And already during the talks, shortly before the Cairo meeting, you shall recall, Pete Botha and Magnus Malan in Johannesburg on their way to Cairo issued a statement for the first time saying that at the negotiations they are going to insist on the withdrawal of six military camps of the ANC by June 1989. We have been told that the issue has not been tabled at the discussions itself, but of course it has been raised in various ways during the, you know, coffee breaks and in the corridors. But we already knew that the regime would at some stage, at some key point, when the process is unfolding, would want to use some kind of excuse for not delivering. And the excuse that we're likely to use was the presence of ANC personnel in Angola. And our position was, if we allow ourselves to be left in that kind of situation, in other words, at a point where this has become an issue of international concern, where you are having the United States and everybody else is saying, look, you are the only obstacle, you know, to Angola's independence, to Angola's peace and Namibia's independence. So why don't you move out? We are then going to be forced to move out and move out in a hurry and move out in a haphazard kind of way, because at that point, you are not even able to ensure proper movement in the proper sense of the word. It is just really, in fact, just responding to pressure. So our feeling was it would be important to move on our own steam, determine exactly where we're going, and also deny the regime the opportunity to use us as an excuse for not delivering. So that decision was taken, and indeed the ANC moved this personnel from Angola. Whether or not this is going to affect the process of struggle that is being waged by the ANC can be determined by a number of factors. One, Angola provided training facilities for ANC personnel, not a launching pad. So if you have training facilities elsewhere and the same kind of training possibilities exist, so from the point of view of training itself per se, nothing has happened. We are told that this is going to be more difficult now to move from point A to point B etc. We do not think that is going to be the case. We do, of course, admit that this has had a serious problem on the ANC in terms of the amount of time that is going to be spent in getting involved in this kind of operation, the amount of resources that are required in order to effect this kind of thing. This indeed, in fact, nobody disputes. But in terms of the commitment and in terms of the ability to carry on what the ANC has been doing, there is no question about that. The ANC, we still, in fact, poised in a situation where it can carry through. We think that there are other considerations here on the South African situation. That was the impact of the Southwestern Agreement on the South African situation. At the level of the white community, we think that this is, in fact, the agreement itself is a severe blow to the military in South Africa. In this sense that for years now, the South African military has been persuaded to think that they have an important role in defending South Africa's borders against the onslaught of communism, terrorism, and what have you. And this was a justification given for having them dying in substantial numbers in Angola and in Namibia. Now they are being told that, well, there is not no onslaught. You can come back. And the question that is being raised by some of them is, if why did we need to go there in the first place? I mean, why if now we can say we're pulling out and we're allowing Namibia's independence process to go on, why was it necessary to be there in the first place? And it raises new questions. Have been told that our task is in fact to defend South Africa against a communist onslaught. We are now being deployed in African townships where occasionally we are called upon to shoot at young children, 6-year-olds. Do they really pose a threat? I mean, do they really consist of the Marxist or communist threat? It is raising new problems with the South African Defense Force and therefore creating problems for the army itself. We have had within the South African Defense Force a number of soldiers who refuse to go and serve in the military in increasing numbers. In the past years, they used to use their religious beliefs as a reason for not participating in the army, but increasingly they are saying in an open way that it is for political reasons that they are refusing to do this. So this is creating problems within the South African military. It is also, of course, I think to a great extent, minimize somewhat the position that the defense generally and security forces were playing in policy making in South Africa. At a time when the army and security forces were seen to be determining policy, were seen to be leading South Africa into victories as they thought in Angola, this tended to put policy making squarely on the lap of the security forces. But the agreement itself has changed all that now. We seem to see in South Africa now emerging what some have called the civilian politicians, represented foremost by people like F.W. de Klerk. And this is, well, there's a different question altogether, what is happening within the white power structure. But the point that one is making is that apart from the psychological impact, there have been also other pressures arising out of the agreement in Southwest Africa. And people are saying, but don't you think that if you withdraw the South African army from Angola and from Namibia, aren't you going to find a situation where the army now, which was thinly spread, is now going to be concentrated in South Africa and therefore making things a little difficult for whoever wants to rise up against the South African regime? Don't you think that this is, in fact, something that ought to be addressed and seen as, in fact, negative to South African liberation struggle? Then we say no. In a mechanical way, yes, one could say that there are more forces in there now than there were before, and therefore the ability of the South African regime to impose its will on the people is going to be much greater. But that's not how things work out. If one were to take the example of the American forces in Vietnam, the pullout, I mean, did not result in over-enthusiasm by American forces to be spread out all over the place. I mean, they could easily have been deployed to various other places now that they've been freed of the Vietnam involvement. But that's not how it happened. In fact, what actually happened was there was the sense of feeling that perhaps we need to re-examine the whole question of our involvement elsewhere. And I think this is what is actually happening within the South African Armed Forces itself. So you are not likely to see a great enthusiasm on those that come from Namibia and from Angola in being deployed in other strategic areas within South Africa itself in order to defend South Africa. I don't think this is what's going to happen. What then does the ANC want to do under the circumstances? To come back to the topic, what is it that the ANC wants to do? First thing that the ANC says in relation to the question is, we have not been persuaded that anything in South Africa has happened that requires us to tone down the tempo of the struggle. As a matter of fact, over the years, what we have seen is, in fact, a situation where the regime's repression has, in fact, intensified. In other words, back in 1984-83, we were calling for the release of political prisoners. We were calling for the unbanning of those organizations that have been banned, political organizations and other organizations. We are calling for a whole host of things. We issued a statement as ANC in which we defined our position towards negotiations. And one of the things that we said was that we believe in negotiations as ANC. We think negotiations are important. That we have been forced to adopt armed struggle is not because we are married to violence as such, but in fact, we are responding to a violence that has been coming our way from the South African regime. But in order for negotiations to take place, we think that there are certain confidence-building measures that have to be adopted by the South African regime. Some of these include, one, the release of political prisoners, because otherwise, who are you negotiating with? If the leaders of people are all in prison, or in exile, or somewhere else, you need to have a situation where they come out and consult with the people, get a mandate from the people on the basis of which they can negotiate. What has happened since then is that the state of emergency has been declared. We have now, in 1988 alone, something like 34 more organizations banned. Now, nobody can try and say to us that this means that the regime is moving closer to negotiations. In fact, it is moving further away from negotiations. We talked about the release of political prisoners, Nelson Mandela and other political prisoners. But what has happened now is that because of the state of emergency, you have a lot more political prisoners in their thousands in South African prisons. Again, we cannot be told that this means that the regime is ready to negotiate. The South African black educational system is in a state of mess. And as if that is not enough, you have certain universities, like the University of the North, occupied by the army on a daily basis. The townships are occupied by the army. So rather than showing any signs, in our view, any signs of change or moving in the direction of talks, we get the impression, a distinct impression, that in fact the South African regime is moving away, contrary to what is happening in Namibia and elsewhere, and contrary to what we're being told. So our position, therefore, under the circumstances, there is nothing much we can do except to intensify the struggle at all its levels. Armed struggle, as well as the political struggle, mass mobilization inside the country, etc. We need to do that. Number two, whereas in international relations, we are told that the rapprochement that has taken place between the Soviet Union and the United States has led to a climate which allows the South African government to experiment on a whole host of things, including the whole question of negotiations, and that therefore there is some need to accommodate or encourage South Africa. We are saying, yes, there is a need to encourage South Africa, but the way to encourage South Africa is not by lessening pressure. In other words, we are saying we have been calling for sanctions throughout, and we are therefore, in fact, saying that the need for more sanctions is here rather than, you know, than it was before. Congress in 1986, which were very useful, but fell far short of what, you know, the people of South Africa demanded. Ought really to be, you know, intensified. Here we're not talking, debating whether or not, I mean, sanctions work or sanctions should be applied. I think the debate has moved beyond that. What we're talking about is how to make the sanctions work, in other words, to plug all the loopholes that we have in the sanctions, and in fact intensify the sanctions. And this is what we are. And we brush aside all these arguments about sanctions are going to hurt black people and so on. And I don't think we need to debate that. I mean, it's all kind of, it's a nauseating argument, to say the least. Black people are going to be hurt most, et cetera, et cetera. Like Bishop Tutu said, he said he was indeed very highly touched about the old concern over black people being, you know, hard hit, et cetera, et cetera. Belated as this concern is, but certainly this is not what we're talking about now. What we are talking about is sanctions and sanctions now on the international front. The one point that I would like to make, Soviet Union, ANC, because this has got some kind of, it has become highly topical. People saying, well, what's happened to the Soviet Union? As a matter of fact, we were told that the Soviet Union seems to be, in fact, embracing constructive engagement in some of the ways it does things, and that it has changed its attitude towards the ANC. It has laid more emphasis and more stress on negotiated settlement as opposed to armed struggle. That's correct. The Soviet Union has, in fact, increasingly spoken in favor of negotiated settlement. But whether this has got any bearing on its relations with the ANC is something that we need to debate. I mean, we issued a statement on negotiations in which we said that we favor negotiations. We agree with negotiations. In fact, if we had it our own way, we'd have been negotiating. That's why for 48 years the ANC was seeking to negotiate. It's only when it was outlawed in 1960 that it decided to adopt armed struggle. But even then, the prospect of negotiating has never been left aside. Now, if we have said that, and if the Soviet Union is saying that, to me that doesn't suggest that, in fact, there's friction or there's a dichotomy between the positions of the Soviet Union and the ANC. In fact, one can even say that the positions are coming much closer together. What the Soviet Union is now saying is something that the ANC has been saying all along. So that cannot be used as an indicator that the Soviet Union is adopting a negative or perhaps less supportive position towards the ANC. I think a determinant there would be to what extent the Soviet Union would be seen to be allowing the ANC to pursue its own policies. I think if you wanted to determine whether or not there is a problem, you would want to say, has the Soviet Union in its relations with the ANC displayed in some way a tendency towards restricting the ANC or circumscribing the manner in which the ANC is conducting its struggle? I would find no evidence of that. As a matter of fact, a visit by the Soviet, by the ANC president, to the Soviet Union, which incidentally the media wanted to use to show that in fact the Soviet Union has minimized its support by saying that Oliver Tambo was not met by Gorbachev. That shows that in fact the ANC is losing support, or the Soviet Union is lessening support. The point is that the ANC delegations go to Moscow, you know, on several occasions. The ANC president has gone there on several occasions. And it is not in all these occasions that he has asked for a meeting with the head of state. So one cannot say because we have not seen the head of state, that in fact indicates that, you know, as a matter of fact, you can count the number of times that the ANC president has met Gorbachev. To my recollection, I think it's only once. But I don't think that meeting would have then said, suggested that, you know, as a matter of fact, each time that the ANC president goes to Moscow, then he must see Gorbachev, never mind what happens. But I'm saying that during that visit, the Soviet, the delegation of the ANC discussed with the Soviets a wide range of issues, including the question of the struggle in South Africa. And of course, I mean, the Soviets also expressed their position, which has been articulated in the media and elsewhere, about favoring political settlement of things and so on, of disputes and conflicts. And the ANC, of course, agreed that, in fact, this is how things should be. But under the circumstances, the ANC does not find its way towards abandoning struggle, armed struggle, because the conditions that led to the ANC's adoption of armed struggle have not, in fact, disappeared. As a matter of fact, the conditions, it has become more necessary, given what is happening right now. So the ANC is not about to do so. And as a matter of fact, the Soviet side did not insist on this. The prerogative is the ANC's to determine how it wants to wage struggle. It is also very interesting that it is particularly around this time that you find Margaret Thatcher in a statement that she issues before embarking on a Southern African tour, saying, on being asked whether she would meet the ANC, she says no, because they have not renounced violence. But around the same time, you find Johan Haynes, very respectable in the Afrikaner church, which has been used over the years to, in fact, give a philosophic and theological basis for apartheid, saying that it is unreasonable for anybody to demand of the ANC to renounce violence as a precondition to negotiations, because the conditions that led to the ANC's adoption of armed struggle have not disappeared. So you wonder where everybody is. I mean, the roles seem to be so reversed. But I think the point here is captured, that we have not been forced, and we are not likely to be forced, or at any rate, we are not likely to give in to any kind of pressure from any direction imposing on us on how to conduct our struggles. We are not saying nobody's going to bring about pressure. Certainly some people might want to do that. But we think that it is our prerogative to determine the instruments by which we want to see our own liberation.
I think I'm going to exercise a little pressure here and ask you to stop so that we can have enough time to discuss the issues that you've raised. That's all right.
It's all right, Bumpy. Did you answer if they come?
Yes.
All right. Over the years, there have been various levels of cooperation between ANC and SWAPO at the very top level, and also at the middle level, if you want, and also at the bottom rung of the ladder. Consultations which are both formal and informal. And we have shared and exchanged experiences and had discussions on a whole wide range of issues. That's question number one. What are the levels? But as far as the developments, the latest developments in Namibia are concerned, we can only say this, that at the time when the 435 resolution was being debated at the UN, the one issue that was not seriously addressed, in our view, this is the view of SWAPO and is also our view, and incidentally, it's also the view of the frontline states and African countries generally, that when 435 was being negotiated, the presence of Namibian forces, SWAPO forces in Namibia, was taken for granted. In other words, there was nothing that suggested the fact that there are no forces, SWAPO forces in Namibia. Anyway, how would you explain the fact that there's fighting that's going on for years if there are no SWAPO forces inside? But the question which was not addressed was this. If you're talking in terms of confining South African troops in two bases within Namibia, what do you then do with those SWAPO forces that are around within the country? That question was not answered. It was raised, and the South Africans raised very serious objections to the question, and it was pushed aside. So that when the agreement is then signed and agreements reached on what happens, this little problem, which becomes very problematic now, is not addressed. Now, the issue here as to whether, you know, SWAPO forces came from outside or whether they were within, I think becomes a moot point in this, that if, for instance, they were inside already, or if they were coming from outside and they were discovered when they are inside, the point is we have SWAPO forces inside, and what does the agreement say about them? Nothing. The question of confining them to beyond the 16th parallel inside Angola and Zambia, something that comes up very recently, and SWAPO did not accept that, did not concede that, was never consulted on that. Because all the time what SWAPO was saying was, we have our people who have been inside Namibia, and the mechanism has been worked out to determine where they should go. So there, in fact, was a flaw. The seeds of this present crisis in Namibia were sown, in fact, at the time when the whole process was being negotiated. And the omission to determine exactly what to do with the Namibian forces or SWAPO forces in Namibia, I think, resulted or led very seriously to the problems that we're having today now. The other thing is, the South African regime says that for something like a week, they have been observing, prior to April 1st, they had been observing the movement of SWAPO forces into Namibia. Two questions. If you have been observing them, why didn't you call an urgent meeting of the Joint Monitoring Commission, Angola and Cuban and so on, which, amongst other things, had the responsibility to monitor the border there? Why did that not happen? And why lay out an ambush? Unless, of course, if you would like us to believe that the whole idea of the exercise may have been to cause this kind of crisis, and therefore try and use this occasion to flush out all the other forces that are in Namibia. In other words, arrive at a point where you actually get an agreement to be made that all SWAPO forces explicitly must leave and go to beyond the 16th parallel. So this is a question that needs to be addressed. I mean, I'm not referring to the question of Atisari allowing the Battalion 101 to get involved. This is something apart. But I'm just saying that it would seem to me that the South Africans also had some allowed of this situation to happen precisely because they wanted not only to make political capital out of this, you know, with some kind of propaganda bonanza, but they also, in my view, wanted to use this occasion in order to get a definite statement on getting out whatever Namibian forces, SWAPO forces, were in Angola.
Question on your statement, maybe I misunderstood, that South Africa is supposed to supervise elections in Namibia. I thought the UN was there to do that. Number two, your statement that the South Africans were surrounded at Quito, Bonavale, I think is pushing the facts a little bit. And on the question of the South African forces laying an ambush in Namibia, they were confined to bases, had deactivated, and in fact, it took till Sunday afternoon for them to get out of their garrisons. I find that not quite consistent with what you're saying.
Okay. Let's start with the role of South African administrator in Namibia. The de facto authority in Namibia is the administrator general of Namibia, in effect, representative of the South African government. The role of the United Nations is not to administer Namibia right now. The role of the UN forces, both the civilian and military component, is in fact to create that kind of climate that enables free and fair elections to take place without any intimidation from the South African forces. The UN forces are not there to administer the elections, the election process. The de facto authority that would have to see to that is the South African imposed or appointed authority. So it is not the UN which is actually on a day-to-day basis going ahead. Certainly, the UN has got an interest in ensuring that this process proceeds unhindered and without undue influence imposed by South Africa on the people. But the de facto authority, the de jure authority might be the UN itself, but in fact, the authority in Namibia, up till the time that Namibia becomes independent, is the Administrator General of Namibia, which in fact means the South Africans. You see, if you talk in terms of supervising and wanting to restrict the definition, I think it's really a moot point. The point is this, that the person who lays down the regulations, who actually ensures that the machinery for such elections is there, and ensures that the dates and everything, the timetable is met, it is the South Africans, really. It is the Administrator General. And like I'm saying, the role of the UN there is not to run anything, much more than to ensure that the Namibian people feel free to go into the process without any kind of intimidation from the South Africans. So my contention is, in fact, it is the South Africans that are running the show there. The Namibian forces are intended, the UN forces are intended, in fact, to generate this kind of climate that will ensure that there is free and fair elections. Because otherwise, the South Africans left to their own designs. I mean, they could just do whatever they like. They're still doing whatever they like right now, you know. Irrespective of UN presence there, unfortunately. But that was the purpose of the UN forces there, not so much to actually administer or to supervise anything, but to actually ensure that what the South African regime is doing is in fact in line with the internationally accepted agreements. Kwito Kinyavala, well, you are a military man, and possibly, I mean, you have you're privy to information and secrets which we don't have. But unfortunately, we also have, have some presence in Angola, and therefore very close to Angolan sources, and therefore have got some kind of reading of the situation there. I think all the accounts that have been published about South African forces in Kudukonambala have pointed in one direction, and in one direction only, that the South African forces were in fact surrounded Kudukonambala. Now, you say I'm pushing it a little further. I don't know what that means, whether it means they were not totally surrounded or whether they were just partially surrounded or whether they were incapacitated, they were unable to move. But the point is, there was no way in which the South African forces were going to move out of that encirclement without sustaining very heavy damages. One is not saying that they would, to the last man, not have been able to go out. But what one is saying is that if the South Africans had tried to fight their way back into Angola without this... back into Namibia without this kind of agreement, certainly the damage that they would have sustained as a regime, as an army, would have been quite appreciable. And I think this is precisely what the South African regime was trying to do in order to avoid this kind of, the extent of damage. This is what I meant by encirclement. The third point. Have I answered that? No. What are the third
point? The third point was fact that the South African forces were confined to bases in Namibia.
Oh, could it have ambushed?
In fact, despite the beginning of infiltration on Saturday the 1st, they did not get out of their garrisons until Sunday afternoon the 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
If they had been laying an ambush, they would have been out there already.
By the way, the fact that the South Africans laid an ambush came from the South Africans themselves. What do I say, off the record now?
Now you're off the record.
South African ambassador at the United Nations, in a private briefing, in a private session, did in fact use the word ambush himself. That, well, perhaps I shouldn't say that. Not certainly not to the ANC. But he did, in fact, use the word ambush. Perhaps ambush in this sense, but it should not be interpreted in a acceptable sense of the word or the normally understood sense of the word, in that, I mean, they just waited for it. What it actually meant was this, that conflict could have been avoided. If, as they say, they had known about this movement for something like a week prior to the April 1st fight, they could have avoided it, but they didn't. They chose, in fact, to fight it out. Now, you're saying that they were confined. That's not correct. 1st of April was the day on which the process for confinement was going to take place. It was not by the wave of a magic wand, everybody suddenly in the camp. Movement towards the confinement of troops. Confinement did not start on the 1st of April, did not start before the 1st of April. In other words, according to the timeline in Namibia, 1st of April was not going to be the end, in other words, where everybody is confined to bases. 1st of April was going to be the commencement of the confinement process. So in fact, they were not confined. They were moving in the direction of being confined.
Okay.
No. Okay. Well, I mean, we have different team of me. Anyway, let me just complete the thought. That the South African regime had to go to the Mati Atisari and ask for a specific thing, it was in fact to get the sanction, in our view, the sanction of the representative of the Secretary General to allow South Africa to now reverse itself and not work towards the process of confining South African forces or the forces to base, but in fact to reverse itself and go back. But our contention, and of course also the contention of the South African army, is that they were not confined. They were actually being confined. And that entails the entire process. I mean, to move military forces from point A to point B is not something that just happened overnight. I mean, you know better than I do. You're a military man, so I won't lecture you on how this process takes place. But it is our considered, maybe wrong, I don't know, but our considered position that, in fact, South African forces were still up and about.
I'd like to shift a little bit to the political process. We all agree there should be an end of, John Strumlaw, there should be an end of apartheid, and it should come by political means rather than military means. Even the Soviets are now rhetorically on board for that. Trying to split the autocratic South African white establishment is an objective that your more moderate statements presumably contribute to, including Mandela's. What sort of interests me is whether or not, as the ANC and the UDF look to the future and your own leadership changes, which age is bound to dictate, you thought about the political process for bringing about, you were born in 1948, bringing about, symbolically enough, bringing about a change of generation within the ANC and the process and the transparency of that process.
The problem, as the ANC understands, is not a question of gender or age within the leadership of the ANC, which therefore would necessitate some kind of changes within the leadership. I think there is no problem there, in spite of the advanced age of some of the members in the leadership. I think the ANC is an organization that sufficiently is able to rejuvenate itself as it goes along, that it takes with it, you know, even people that come from the older generation. But your question specifically on whether or not we have given some thought to the political process leading to a negotiated settlement or through change.
The political process within the ANC for an inevitable change of leadership and in or without involvement of those inside. I just wonder how you're thinking about the future. Mandela was to be released in the next year or so. What role would he play in ensuring that the ANC becomes the sole voice or the predominant voice in a negotiating process with the other side, which the international community seems prepared to accept if you can credibly claim that you're a legitimate spokesman of the South African people? It's a big and difficult question, I realize, but an interesting one.
Yeah. Very interesting and very difficult. Let me say this, that the ANC, much as it claims to speak on behalf of South African people, that it has actually retained the traditions of struggle, has never at any stage excluded the possibility in a negotiation process of including other people, you know, on the side of the democratic forces. Time and again, it has issued statements that have clearly shown that it does not see itself as the sole negotiator. In other words, it's not just a question of the ANC versus the regime, but it is in fact the democratic forces of which the ANC is part of versus the regime and whoever else the regime wants to take on its side. So this brings into light the question of, well, those that are inside South Africa, ANC members and non-ANC members, those that are in prisons and those that are in exile. That is precisely why when we say that for a negotiated settlement to be a viable option, what you need to do is have the regime release political prisoners. That's exactly what we mean by this. Release political prisoners, unban the people's organizations. In other words, to ensure that you have precisely that kind of climate and that kind of presence or that kind of consultation and interaction, not only between the ANC and its members, but within the democratic forces are put together. In our view, the problems in South Africa cannot be seen to have been resolved unless you address the serious difficulties that are facing the workers in South Africa. In other words, that gives a very prominent position to the trade union movement. And therefore, one does not see how any kind of negotiation can take place without the participation of the voice of the workers now as represented by the trade union movement. Various other strata, the youth, women's organizations, etc., religious organizations, religious personalities, and so on. So the ANC does not claim to the right to represent or to speak on behalf of everybody in this kind of negotiations. But what the ANC does in fact say is that in a negotiated process of this kind, certainly you'd need to have all the other members of the democratic community in South Africa. Now, as to what role or what position the ANC is going to take later on, I think it's really a matter that can be determined thereafter. I think it is to the extent to which the ANC will be able to present itself to the people of South Africa as representing a certain kind of leadership that will determine